Kimberly Atkins Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. A little over a week ago, as they went about their weekend errands on a muggy Saturday afternoon, 10 people were shot to death and 3 injured at the Tops Friendly supermarket in a predominantly black neighborhood of Buffalo, New York. The 18-year-old alleged gunman is said to have embraced a racist conspiracy theory known as the Great Replacement Theory.
The shooting in Buffalo, New York has been connected to this theory because it was repeatedly referenced in a 180-page document linked to the reported shooter. The author used racist, anti-immigrant, and anti-Semitic beliefs and wrote about how he planned to, quote, kill as many blacks as possible.
Proponents of the Great Replacement Theory believe that politically motivated liberal elites are intentionally encouraging and enabling non-white immigrants to come to the U.S. with the goal that those immigrants will outnumber native-born Americans. Proponents like Fox News host Tucker Carlson.
There is a strong political component to the Democratic Party's immigration policy. We're not guessing this. We know this, and we know it because they have said so. The Democratic Party has decided then, rather than convince you, people who are born here, that their policies are helping you and making the country better and stronger, they will change the electorate. Again, they say that. We're not guessing.
And it's not just Carlson. The conspiracy theory has also been espoused by former President Donald Trump, Representative Elise Stefanik of New York, Matt Gaetz of Florida, and Brian Babin of Texas.
On every face, we can see every aspect the Democrats are trying to change America from what we know, what we love, and what we have enjoyed for 244 years.
The reality is that the America that people like Brian Babin have enjoyed for 244 years is changing, regardless of political intention. Between 2010 and 2020, the percentage of Americans who identified as white only declined by more than 10 points, from 72 to 62%. It's projected that by 2045, white Americans will be a minority, and that is fuel for racist conspiracy theories.
Hate. That through the media and politics, the internet has radicalized angry, alienated, lost, and isolated individuals into falsely believing that they will be replaced. That's the word, replaced. I call on all Americans to reject the lie. And I condemn those who spread the lie for power, political gain, and for profit.
President Biden there speaking in Buffalo last week. But those radicalized individuals are not small in number, nor isolated. According to a recent AP poll, 1 in 3 Americans believe an effort is underway to replace native-born Americans with immigrants for electoral gains. And the very fear and paranoia around being, quote, replaced, has come up time and time again in other mass shootings. In 2015, in Charleston, South Carolina, where 9 black people were killed. In 2019, in El Paso, Texas, where 23 people were killed, most of them Hispanic. And in 2017, at the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, the theory became a chant. French white nationalist writer Renaud Camus has been credited with devising the Great Replacement Theory in his 2011 book of the same name. But several historians we spoke with argue that this theory, at least the ideology behind it, came along well before 2011. In fact, they say, it's always been a part of America's story. Joining us now to help tell this story is Jeffrey Robinson. He is the founder and president of the Who We Are Project, which aims to correct the narrative on the history of anti-black racism in the United States. He's joining us from Seattle, Washington. Welcome to On Point, Jeffrey.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we're also joined by Ricky Jones. He's the professor and chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at the University of Louisville. And he's joining us from Louisville, Kentucky. Welcome to On Point, Ricky.
Thank you, Kimberly. Hello.
So I want to start this conversation by that last point that was made, that we think about the Great Replacement Theory. A lot has been made about this French writer, but it really goes back to America's founding and the era and institution of slavery. Jeffrey, tell us about that.
Well, I think it is humorous to suggest that somebody in 2011 came up with this. I'm just going to read you something really quickly. Civilization's going to pieces. I've gotten to be a terrible pessimist about things. The idea is if we don't look out, the white race will be utterly submerged. It's all scientific stuff. It's been proved. It's up to us, who are the dominant race, to watch out, or these other races will have control of things. That's from the first chapter of the book, The Great Gatsby, in 1925. Which was the year after the Johnson-Reed Act, which based immigration in this country on national origin. So this is nothing new. And if you go back to colonial America, not just constitutional America, the importation of enslaved people from Africa was a huge part of our country. The ships that we sent were named Desire, Fortune, Hope, and Prosperity. The first four American-made ships sent to Africa to go get more enslaved people. We were passing laws in colonial America that said if an enslaved woman has a child, that child is an enslaved person. And that law was required because white men would rape black women, and it wasn't a crime. But not only was it not a crime, when those children were born, the law wanted to make clear, don't go thinking blue eyes or freckles makes that a human being. That is an enslaved being. Virginia passed more than 130 quote-unquote slave statutes. And I'll end by saying this. 1619, we have reports of 20 and odd people being brought to America. There were enslaved people here before that, but the numbers we're understanding are just beginning. By 1790, that number was 700,000. And by 1860, it was 4 million.
Wow. So Ricky, I want to bring you in here, and as we're talking about the colonial era and the ideology of great replacement theory that was beginning even then, how do we distinguish that from institutional racism, which is something that we talk a lot too? Those are two different things.
Yeah, but they're connected. I certainly would like to say, Kimberly, at the outset, hello to Jeffrey. I'm a great fan of the outstanding work he does with the Who We Are project, the Who We Are project, and having a serious understanding of history, which we need in this country. But you're very right. It is very difficult or I would say impossible for us to have this discussion without understanding the ideological underpinnings of what America is really about racially. And I always try to start the discourse with people understanding what white supremacy really is and institutional racism, these things really are. And when I talk about white supremacy, I'm not talking about some cartoonish understanding of it, of, you know, people in Charlottesville chanting, "You will not replace us," or of Dylann Roof or the Ku Klux Klan burning crosses on people's yards. But the ideological premise of a good percentage of our white brothers and sisters in the country that stretch back to the founding of the country, that because of their race, they are the people who have the right to think, know, and decide. And so when you go back to the Alien Sedition Act of 1798 to Plessy versus Ferguson or before that, to the Hayes-Tilden Compromise, which we'll talk about later, to Dred Scott, you see all of these movements to ensure white dominance in the country. It's become more sophisticated over time as it's morphed, but it's always present. And so I think that it's important that we have sophisticated discussions about this type of sophisticated hegemonic dynamic.
And Jeffrey, on that point, the difference between ensuring white dominance in a society and racism, as some people may think about it, which is a negative feelings toward people of a certain race, it's important to distinguish that when we talk about things in American history, things like the one drop rule or the three-fifths compromise. Those weren't just meant to penalize black people. They were meant to help secure white power, right?
No, I think the three-fifths compromise is probably the clearest example of a country going from colonial times where enslaving people was just rampant. And all of that money and all of that history was on the table at the Constitutional Convention. And they were figuring out, what are we going to do about this? And how, and many people were feeling, how are we going to protect it? Patrick Henry, many people will remember him, "Give me liberty or give me death." Well, during the Constitutional Convention, he wrote a letter that basically said, there are 236,000 blacks in Virginia and few or none in the northern states. Now, what he was concerned about was, what happens if those black people decide they want to be free and we need guns to keep them where they are? But his point was more important. Multiply 236,000 by 3/5 and you still get a huge number, especially given the population of the 13 colonies at that time. And this number, that 3/5 rule, was used to increase the number of delegates in Congress and to increase the number of votes in the Electoral College. And if you wonder if it was an effective way to protect the institution of slavery, out of the first 12 presidents of the United States, 9 of them were from the South and 7 were from Virginia. So it did exactly what it was designed to do. The 3/5 clause wasn't just about dehumanizing black people. The 3/5 clause was about money and power.
We are discussing how the so-called Great Replacement Theory is not a new phenomenon, but in fact has been part of America's past as far back as the very beginning. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. Today, we're discussing how the so-called Great Replacement Theory is not a recent phenomenon, but goes all the way back to America's founding. We're joined by Jeffrey Robinson. He's the founder and president of the Who We Are Project, which aims to correct the narrative on the history of anti-Black racism in the United States. We're also joined by Ricky Jones, a professor and chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at the University of Louisville. So I want to talk now about the era in American history after the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which were not just meant to end the institution of slavery and emancipate Black people who had been enslaved, but also try to make them more actively participating full citizens with the levers of citizenship that comes with that. It's called the Reconstruction Era. But Ricky, that is when there were several instances that demonstrate just how much the ideology behind the Great Replacement Theory was perpetuated during that era. Can you tell us about some of those, starting with the New Orleans Massacre of 1866 at the Louisiana Constitutional Convention?
Right. And when we talk about what happens where there's a constitutional convention in New Orleans where Black people theoretically are moving to the point in 1866. Remember, Blacks still do not have the right to vote in 1866. That's not given until 1870 with the passage of the 15th Amendment. And then it's important to note that even in 1870, with the passage of the 15th Amendment, only Black men are given the right to vote, which accentuates more American contradictions. It's another 50 years before any woman in the country is given the right to vote with the passage of the 19th Amendment in 1920. But what we're seeing with what happens in New Orleans is just a continuation of violence towards Black people who are fighting, one, not just for citizenship, but recognition as human beings. And we have whites literally going into that Constitution Hall and firing shots at Black people who are fighting for the right to be recognized as citizens and human beings in New Orleans. And you have scores of Black people who are killed. That is a continuation of violence that happened a few months earlier in Memphis, where you see that same thing replicated. But if you look throughout the history of the country, white violence towards Blacks who are fighting for that equal footing to be seen on the world stage as human beings is not uncommon. Stonewall Rebellion in 1739, New York Insurrection 1741, Gabriel Prosser in Virginia in 1820. We move forward to 1822. With Denmark Vesey in South Carolina, David Walker's appeal, 1829, Nat Turner, 1831 in Virginia. It goes on and on and on, this level of violence as Black people are trying to integrate themselves into the society. So Reconstruction is a very important period in American history that has not been thoroughly studied, and the violence that comes during Reconstruction when Black people, after the fourth, freed with the 13th Amendment, given citizenship with the 14th, the right to vote in the 15th, and there is great pushback from Memphis to New Orleans and across the country, because remember, organizations like the Ku Klux Klan are post-Civil War phenomena, not pre-Civil War phenomena. So again, you see this violence in New Orleans and other places along lines of race.
And Jeffrey, it's important to know that there's a similarity with what we're hearing today, which is that the fear that Black and brown people will change the electorate, and that includes instances go far beyond that. It's about power. And so tell us about the Wilmington insurrection of 1898. Is that another example of that?
Well, it's a direct example of the fear of political power resting in the Black community. There was actually a fusion party in North Carolina in the 1890s, Black and white politicians who formed a coalition, and they were for free education and debt relief and equal rights for Black people. And in 1896, they actually won every statewide office, including the governorship. That's how powerful this coalition was. And in 1898, a mix of Black and white fusionists were elected to lead the local city government in Wilmington. And the Democrats, at that time, it was the Democrats. And Democrats and Republicans have switched roles in this throughout history. So this isn't about one political party or another. It's about America. The Democrats weren't having it, and they launched what was one of the most deliberately racist campaigns that America has ever seen. And on election day, or November 10th of 1898, white people met as a mob. They burned the office of the Daily Record, the Black-owned newspaper. Untold Black people were left dead. The entire city government was overthrown. The coup leaders established themselves at the city government and went forward. And no consequences, no arrest. Historians say this is the only successful coup in American history. And they did it with the police knowing that they did it. There's an infamous picture of all these white folks standing in front of the Daily Record, the newspaper building that was burned. And they didn't mind their pictures being taken because they knew there would be no consequences from what they did. That was a direct statement of, you actually got political power through the system we claim to love, and we are snatching it back.
I want to talk about fear, because it seems that so much of this is based on scare tactics and fear. We have a comment from a listener on Facebook, and he says, the problem is it's a real fear buried within white Americans, of which I am one. We can be generous and magnanimous with others and say, I'm not racist. I believe in equality for all. But deep down, there's an inner voice saying, as long as we remain in control, there is a fear of what might happen if the white race that has controlled America since day one is no longer the majority. Ricky, fear seems to be the underlying basis of this, even if it's unfounded.
That's a great point by your listener that it is about fear, but it's also about this idea of privilege and what mm-hmm. is their right. Many of white citizens in America feel that the country was founded by them and for them, and they're simply not willing to give it up. So there is a through line that we see whenever you see the scales even tilted, not balanced, but tilting towards balance, that there is pushback. So it's essential that we continue to contextualize this historically, as we talked about Reconstruction. But look at how Reconstruction ends with the election of 1876, where you have Samuel L. Tilden on the Democratic side and Rutherford B. Hayes on the Republican side. And you have contested electoral votes in states like Louisiana, South Carolina, and Florida. Florida never seems to be able to get it right. But the only thing keeping the South in line during this time is the presence of federal troops in the South. And the Democrats make a deal. They say, look, we'll give Hayes the presidency if you remove federal troops from the South. And you would think that the Republicans wouldn't do that, because the troops are the only thing that are keeping whites at that time from being openly, brazenly violent towards black people. But they make the deal for the political power. And you get a nadir period of white violence towards blacks. You get grandfather clauses, you get literacy tests, you get intimidation, you get outright violence towards black people. So political power is related to the social power of white supremacy in the country. And that continues. It's very difficult for us to think, even today in the 21st century, as we talk so much about diversity, equity, and inclusion, it's difficult to cite any social, especially political and professional spaces where blacks are the terminal decision makers, right? We are still mm-hmm. witnessing a more sophisticated brand of white supremacy and control as we look throughout the country, and people are loath to give that up. So there is that fear, right? And there is that privilege. There is that feeling that there's a God-given right to, again, think, know, and decide about everything of consequence in the country.
And Jeffrey, when we're talking about that fear and that privilege, it's what was it based on in the Reconstruction era and beyond? Because there was never a time when white people, and as we noted in this, it was white men, really. Even women were not enfranchised until many decades after even black men were, at least constitutionally, if not in actuality. Where was this basis of fear? What did they point to as this basis that the loss of that power could be dangerous?
It was the same thing that they always pointed to. The professor noted the Stono Rebellion in South Carolina in 1739, where within a year, South Carolina passed a 58-chapter law, in their words, not mine, to keep the slave in due subjugation and obedience. I think there's a poem by a young woman named Nahira Wahid, and I'm just going to read it quickly. If we wanted to, people of color could burn the world down for what we have experienced, are experiencing, but we don't. How stunningly beautiful that our sacred respect for the earth, for life, is deeper than our rage. And I feel like there is a psychological part of this fear that is, if they, quote unquote, get into power, they're going to do to us what we did to them.
Whoa,
and
there
that
you go.
Is just that is just the that is just a very deep fear in human beings. And if you are capable of doing the kind of things that have been done to black people in America, if you are capable of watching those things being done and doing nothing about it, then you worry that the folks who are the victims are capable of the exact same thing. And, you know, people joke and say it's not so much fun when the rabbit has the gun. But that is a fear that is a reflection of people's own, I think, discomfort with their either participation in a system or with their failure to resist that system. And so I just want to say quick. Yes. I just want to say quickly, the 13th Amendment, or, you know, abolishing slavery. The 13th Amendment didn't abolish slavery. The 13th Amendment maintained slavery for anyone convicted of a crime. And when the troops left the South, the laws that were instituted and then used in Black communities, the concept of Black communities being over-policed, this is a Reconstruction era kind of thing. This isn't anything new. And so if you go about giving people convictions so that they can't vote, that's another way to restrict their ability to change power. The 15th Amendment didn't give Black men the right to vote. It said you can't restrict the right to vote based on race. But if you want to use a literacy test or a poll tax or some other thing that doesn't use race as a term, go right ahead and do that. And the South was very effective in using these loopholes that you could drive a truck through to maintain their power in the way they did before the Civil War. If the people are already here, then what you have to do is to control their ability to participate in the political system. And that is an effective way of preventing the replacement theory, so to speak, from becoming a reality.
And Ricky, I want to bounce off of that point. Next segment, we're going to get into how the Great Replacement Theory has affected or been driven by economics. But I think one point that I'm hearing here from Jeffrey is a question that I had, which is it the fear of replacement? At least the Black people never were in America the number that could overtake white Americans. In the South, they were at one point, but in the greater country, they weren't. But there is it a fear of replacing white people in the social order? For example, even after abolition, there was indentured servitude, there was sharecropping, there was all of these things that kept Black people more, not just economically depressed, but socially depressed in the order of things. Was that sort of a fear as well?
You know, Kimberly, I think we have to be careful to not talk about this in the past tense. When you look at what's going on with Black people today, the majority of Black people, for outside of the anomalies, you know, of professional athletes or actors or Oprah, when you look at the majority of Black people today, I would argue that from the cradle to the grave, a good percentage of Black people are still in a state of subjugation. We are a servant class people. And you run back to Thomas Jefferson, who spoke about slavery. He said it's like holding a wolf by its ears. And that is a terrifying state. And I think those of us, and Jeffrey started to allude to this, when you talk about this fear, it is a heck of a thing. When you are conscious of the treatment of people, the dehumanization of people, the violence towards men, women, and their children that slavery and racial hegemony have heaped upon Black people now, you know, throughout the history of the country to the present, and the thought of what would these people do if they were put in our position? And that is a difficult, difficult conversation to have, you know. And I heard something profound some time ago, and I often bring it up. We even played it in the intro to the show. Fargo showrunner Noah Hawley said this, and I've never watched the show, but I listened to him on an NPR interview. And Noah Hawley said, you know, there is a certain madness that comes from being a thing, but denying with your last breath that you are that thing. And that is what we really, really see in America, this growing madness of the country, because we are a thing, but we deny that we are that thing. This is a white supremacist country that has been all too comfortable with violence towards Black people and the subjugation of Black people and violence towards Black men, women, and children, where every excuse under the sun is made to justify that morally. And that's what our dear brother James Baldwin was talking about when he said, if you can behave like that and never have a conscience about it, then we have degenerated into a country that houses a good percentage of moral monsters. And what do you do with that reality?
Jeffrey, in just the less than a minute we have in this segment, talk a little bit more about that and the use of violence.
Well, I think that when Thurgood Marshall argued Brown versus the board in the Supreme Court, he said, separate but equal is rooted in the deep desire to keep people who were formerly enslaved as near to that state as is possible. The real point here is that this is deja vu all over again. It's nothing new.
We're discussing how the so-called Great Replacement Theory is not a new phenomenon, but in fact has been part of America's story all the way back to the very beginning. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Today, we're discussing how the so-called Great Replacement Theory isn't new at all, but it's been a part of the American story from the beginning. We're joined by Jeffrey Robinson. He's the founder and president of the Who We Are Project, which aims to correct the narrative of the history of anti-Black racism in America, and also by Ricky Jones, professor and chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at the University of Louisville. So the Great Replacement Theory can be seen, or the ideology behind it, can be seen not only throughout American efforts to suppress the political power of Black people, but also the economic progress and growth of Black people. And a big example of that is the Tulsa Massacre of 1921. And I want to play you sound from Ernestine Alpha Gibbs. She was just 14 years old when the Tulsa Race Massacre happened in 1921. Her family fled their home and camped out at a local fairgrounds until it was over.
When we came to Greenwood, there was not a building standing. There was not anything, and water was running, you know, and we just looked and walked. So then we went on out to where we lived, out to King Street. And of course, all the way out, everything was burnt, you know, everything.
More than 35 city blocks were leveled. An estimated 191 businesses were destroyed, and roughly 10,000 Black residents were displaced from the neighborhood. Although the state declared the massacre's death toll to be only 36 people, most historians and experts who have studied the event estimate the death toll to be between 75 and 300 people. So, Ricky, this was known as the Black Wall Street. It was a sign of economic progress. Talk about the link between the fear, not just of Black political power, but of Black economic power driving incidents like this.
Yes, you know, Kimberly, they're related. And again, I think we need a more sophisticated definition of politics. And as a political scientist, I like to use Harold Laswell's definition of politics, the process that decides who gets what, when, where, and how, right? The process that decides who gets what, when, where, and how. And so when you talk about that, politics is not just about going to the booth and voting. It's about making decisions, about one decision making politically, as well as economic distribution of wealth and the distribution of resources in every space in which we inhabit. So what we see in Tulsa is a situation where Blacks who have basically engaged in black nationalism. They're breaking off from a country. They're saying, look, we don't want you here. And they're trying to build their own internally. And we get that type of neo-nationalist ideology right now, too, in different strains. And not the type of neo-nationalism that we're talking about with white nationalism that is based on racism. But we're talking about black people trying to, in effect, survive and create space where they can function as human beings without the weight of racism for themselves and their children. And so the very sad situation about Tulsa is that you see this happening where people internally are trying to grow and thrive without bothering anybody. It's not like they were impinging upon the white community in that area. And even that was not something that was considered acceptable by the white community. And these people were literally killed and even bombed on American soil by other Americans. So also what's scary is, as we got into the 100th anniversary of Tulsa last year, it was amazing how many people we ran into who didn't know about Tulsa at all. They had no idea about the history of that situation, which says something about American education and how we are socialized to think about all of these issues and why we're so far behind in addressing them in any type of real and meaningful way.
So, Jeffrey, I want to bring this to today. And as you've both made very clear, everything that we've been talking about has very much to do with the present moment as much as it does with history. But as I was thinking about this show, Jeffrey, I think about when we hear the great replacement theory talked about and written about, it's done in terms of immigration, this idea that the people promoting this conspiracy theory are afraid of immigrants coming into America and displacing natural-born Americans, when to me what it actually is, it's fear of black and brown immigrants and black and brown people who are natural born, juxtaposed white natural born people and even immigrants. The former president talked about wanting more immigration from Finland and less from Haiti. We know how he described Mexico and other countries. It seems that that is the through line here, and immigration is almost a false flag.
Well, I think I go back to the Yankee catcher Yogi Berra saying this is deja vu all over again. When you run an institution of enslaving people, and by 1860, you have 4 million of them still alive, you can't get rid of them. So instead of getting rid of them, you institute practices where they can't participate, and then you focus on immigrants. And, you know, the clearest example is, did you ever hear anybody say anything about building a wall on the Canadian border? No, of course not. And this theory of President Trump saying, let's have people from Finland, this is the Johnson-Reed Act from 1924, which prevented immigration from Asia and placed strict limits, not only on Africans, but on Eastern and Southern Europeans. This is literally the same thing all over again. There are no new ideas here. It is simply a retreading of that which has come before, because essentially, the people who are pushing this don't have anything else. There is no substance to which they can point. So this theory keeps getting retread and resurfaced and reshaped, but it's essentially the exact same thing that we have seen from colonial America until today.
I want to talk a little bit about the impact of the messaging that we're hearing, the messages that we've heard at the top of the hour. Aliza Luft is an assistant sociology professor at UCLA. She says, according to the research, dehumanizing anti-Semitic propaganda used during the Holocaust had a positive effect in mobilizing Germans to harm Jews where they were already anti-Semitic, but actually had a backlash effect where anti-Semitism was historically low. She says the same argument can be made today with replacement theory and white and right-wing media.
They wouldn't have a platform if there weren't already people who believe these things. I think it provides a justification for people who want to believe that that's a reason, for whatever reasons they have, for people who might be feeling disenfranchised, for people who are already racist, for people who are looking for someone to blame. This gives them something, an explanation to latch onto. But there are just as many people who do not feel that way and who, no matter how many times you make them watch Tucker Carlson, for example, they're not going to feel that way.
Professor Luft says, quote, people aren't fools. They aren't mindless machines that simply hear dehumanizing propaganda and suddenly change their views on people they've long known, worked with, and lived beside. Ricky, I want to go to you. What are your thoughts on that? And does that go against what we talked about earlier, which is people believing they are one thing but doing a different thing?
Yeah, I agree with one part of what she said and disagree with the last part. I think she's right. People aren't fools. Fox News didn't create this. Fox News was founded in 1996. Tucker Carlson was born in 1969. Donald Trump was born in 1946. This was going on in America long before this organization and these people were ever thought about, and it's still going on. Americans, but they're easy targets. It's easy to scapegoat Fox. It's easy to talk about Tucker Carlson. And I've had personal experiences with Tucker Carlson. I'm not making the argument that these people in this organization are not retrograde. I'm not making the argument that the Republican Party isn't retrograde. But the harder question is, what's going on in America? Did you know that Fox News is the only cable news network to make gains in the first quarter of 2022? It jumped up by 3%. It's led cable news viewing in 81 consecutive quarters. CNN, MSNBC are dropping off the proverbial ratings cliff. So it's not like Fox is creating all of these people who are pushed along, you know, by nativism and racism. It's simply speaking to something that already exists in the country. So folks who say, you know, this is not who we are. No, that's not true. This is exactly who we are as a country. And it runs much deeper than people want to admit. And it's not just relegated to the Republican Party or the far right conservatives. Even white liberals, as Martin Luther King Jr. spoke of, white liberals, when you get to the core of it, don't want to give up decision-making power to black people. So until we engage that and we understand that, until we admit that this is something that runs much deeper than Fox News and Tucker Carlson, because if that was the case, we could get rid of them, wipe them off the air, and we could push Donald Trump off the political stage. And when he exits this plane of existence, America will be OK. But we're not going to be OK just because we get away from them. And that's the conversation that most people do not want to have, that this is a deeply American problem that's been around since the founding of the country.
And Jeffrey, you know, when I was listening to Professor Luft, one thing that sprung to mind for me is that this is much more complicated than that, right? I mean, we saw in the past couple of years, the very same community where you would see blanketed with signs that say Black Lives Matter in white suburban communities would be the same communities that maybe a year or so later, parents are at school board meetings outraged because they believe that their children are being taught that they are racist or that the country is racist, and how deeply offensive that was to those parents. Same people, same community. So isn't it a lot more complex than that, right?
Well, and I think it's what the professor was saying. When you paint this as something that has just happened, then just take care of this current little problem and everything goes away. George Orwell said it most ominously, who controls the past controls the future. There is a reason that people don't want to know the truth about our past, because it gives an explanation for why America looks like it does today that is radically different than the explanation that many people want to latch on to. And so what I see happening, you know, just very quickly, the concept that language doesn't matter. I remember Hillary Clinton talking about predators who were 13 and 14 years old that had to be brought to heel. And what I do is go back through history. Anytime you see government officials start to talk about people in less than human terms, get ready for the less than human treatment. And the explosion in mass incarceration came on the heels of that kind of rhetoric that came from Democrats and Republicans. So I don't agree that words don't matter. I think that words matter. And I think that history matters. America is a great nation, and it is also a racist nation. And those two things can't coexist together forever. And it seems to me that we are literally at a tipping point where we're deciding which way America is going to go. And anyone who looks around the country at the condition that we're in can't avoid that conclusion. So if you are interested in which way America is going to go, it is time to look in the mirror and ask yourself what you're doing about it.
Ricky, as to being at that tipping point, is there a solution to stop the perpetuation of this ideology, or are we doomed to fall on the wrong side of that tipping point?
You know, Kimberly, I don't know. You know, I am certainly less hopeful than I have been. What I do know is this is a country that was founded by men who said all men are created equal, while they simultaneously, a good percentage of them, held slaves. And America is yet to you know, figure out that contradiction. And we are still living with it. So I don't know exactly where we go from here. I have no magic bullet. I wish I was, you know, Harry Potter with a wand who could wave it and figure this out. But I don't know if we've gotten to the point where we're ready to figure it out. We like to talk about it, but I'm not sure if we're really ready to act on multiple levels to figure this out. So I'm not very hopeful right now that we're going to get off the road that we've been on since the founding of the country.
Jeffrey, what are the consequences in thinking about the great replacement theory as something new or something only a decade old, as opposed to something that has been a part of American history and the history of Europe and other places from the beginning?
Anytime you are trying to resolve a problem, you need to understand the root causes of the problem. And if you don't, you will design solutions that are based on the myth of why this problem exists, and those solutions will fail every single time. It is why we have taken two steps forward and three steps backward on racial justice in this country for the last couple of centuries, because we are denying the truth about our past. How, look at the desperation in people who don't want this truth taught. I think it's because they know the impact that it can have on conservative and liberal people. And so what I would say is I'm not saying that I'm Pollyannish or that I'm hopeful, because I'm quite frankly very, very concerned. It's why I left my job at the ACLU to start this project. I think that the desperation you see in people wanting to deny our history is because they know if we all deal with it, we'll go in a different direction. So it's on us now.
Jeffrey Robinson is the founder and president of the Who We Are Project, which aims to correct the narrative on the history of anti-Black racism in the United States. Thank you so much for joining us, Jeffrey.
I really appreciate being here. Love to meet you, Professor.
And Ricky Jones is a professor and chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at the University of Louisville. Thank you, Ricky.
Thank you, Kimberly. And Jeffrey, keep doing the important work you do, brother.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.